And it's a wonderful thing that he does. He knows that, for instance, if you, back in chapter 12, verse 1, follow through with, you're listening to, and you're paying attention to, that I urge you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable unto God, that if you start doing that, that kind of sometimes puts you on a collision course with all that is going on in the world, doesn't it? It causes us to see that, man, if I'm living for Christ, there's some people that don't want me living for Christ. They don't care if I am living for Christ. And so sometimes there can be persecution, sometimes there can be misunderstanding, all kinds of things can sometimes break loose, even with government. There's probably not been, just because we are all human, you know, sometimes we can vote for somebody and we actually think they're going to do everything they said they were going to do, you know. Maybe back when we're first voting, now we know that it's not just a bunch of rhetoric, so to speak, but it's maybe some good intentions, but not everybody's able to accomplish everything that they want to. And in the day when the Bible was written, when Paul was writing this particular letter to the Romans, there were some people who were not Christian friendly back then. You maybe have heard the name of Nero. You've heard of Claudius and Caligula. You've heard of Dionysus and some others who were just bent on making life difficult and killing, wiping out. Nero thought it was the right thing to do to run all of the Christians out of the whole city of Rome. He didn't care who else lived there as far as criminals and undercutting and all those kind of folks, but man, he wanted the believers out because he hated the cause of Christ and did all kinds of things. And so, nonetheless, Scripture says what it does in Romans chapter 13, verse 1. And you see a little word in there that can sometimes say, well, let me get out my little X-Acto knife. That probably doesn't really need to be in there. Where it says, let every person. It's hard to get by, you know, that as applying to us, because it does. We're part of the whole group called every person. To be in, and here's the S word that we sometimes have difficult with, subjection to the governing authorities. Now, he's writing this letter knowing that, yes, it's going to be read in a lot of local church congregations in the city of Rome, but even outside of Rome, they were used to seeing these letters carried or hand-delivered to other churches, like over in modern-day Turkey and what was known as Asia Minor, and some of those cities like Ephesus and Colossae, you know, some of those towns that you're familiar with that where churches were planted. Philippi, you know, those kind of places, Thessalonica, Corinth over in Greece. So this is going to be a widely circulated. There's going to be all kinds of different, some friendly to the cause of Christ, some very much against and antagonistic towards the cause of Christ. But he says, be in subjection to governing authorities. And it's interesting that there's no parentheses that follows that, is there? It's just a statement. And he's not saying be in subjection to the ones that are morally right, that are competent, that don't waste your money, that don't support cronyism, that have a certain degree of limitation, you know, reasonableness and stuff like that. He's saying to the governing authorities, to those who are out there, no matter who it is that is there. And we'll look at a special reason for that in the future. But he says that same thing in 1 Thessalonians 4. He says that over in Timothy chapter 2, 1 Timothy 2, where he says to pray for those who are in authority over you, referring to the governing authorities. And he doesn't again say just pray for the good ones and not pray for the ones that are difficult or hard. So he tries to introduce to us that there is an overflow from, I urge you, therefore, brothers, in 12:1, present your bodies a living sacrifice, and let your love be sincere. And how does that love become sincere? Well, it becomes sincere with all these things that we've talked about, even through hospitality, through our speech, through our desire to not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. All of those kind of things are a part of a sincere love that he wants us to have. And that spills over, of course, into chapter 13, where, you know, not just among yourselves in the local church, but take it to the streets, so to speak. That is, everywhere you go, take Romans chapter 12 with you. Take your commitment to Christ. Take your sincere love and let it affect everyone in that arena that you find yourself in. And that is something that makes a big difference between a genuine believer and, you know, somebody who is maybe out there pretending. Now, he first of all talks about some, or I think he's talking about through this passage, some of the benefits of a God-dependent submission. This, after all, is a military term. It's a term that is part of army, you know, whatever discipline of the armed forces you can think of, where of how someone who is a lesser rank is supposed to respond to someone who is a superior rank. And you have an idea of all that already. Maybe you have been in that situation. I have not been directly, but I, you know, you see it out there, and you don't see a bunch of dialogue, no matter how it's portrayed, between commanding officer and the one who is on the bottom end receiving the command. They don't just say, well, now I'm not sure I want to do this, you know, I have a little ache or pain here, and that kind of, it's just the command is given, and you know what the expected response is. And here it is, where Jesus Christ himself, God himself, is giving us this God-breathed word, saying, I want you in subjection to governing authorities, or I want you to embrace this whole idea of submission. But when we do that, we are actually, you might say, like it says there in your handout, positioning ourselves to honor God. That is, we submit to what God establishes. Like you read the second half of verse 1, it says, for there is no authority except from God. Well, what does that mean to us? Does that mean, you know, our local governor, DeGiovanni, is in mayorship, so to speak, or in that position as mayor of Hackettstown because it was God's will for her? It absolutely does. Does it mean that Barack Obama, as our president, is somebody that God brought into power? Yes, it does mean that. You think, well, come on, I didn't vote for him. How could God think differently than I about his character and, you know, ability to rule and stuff? Does that mean that, you know, some of these folks that are over, you know, oh man, what's the guy over in Iran, Abinadab? Some of these folks that are antagonistic towards the nation of Israel, does that mean that he brought, yes, it does. Every single person, every corner of the world, it's God that is supervising the passing on of power from one group to another. And we look in from the outside and we say, well, if I don't see this, this, and this of the good, then I can't imagine how God is using that in his mind, in his scheme of things, as he's ruling and reigning the whole thing, the whole planet, the whole universe. But he is using it. So we don't say, well, okay, that gives me permission to blame God. No, it gives me an opportunity to submit to what God has allowed, what God has put in place, supervised to be in place, and it just launches us into a whole new understanding of how Romans chapter 12, verses 1 and 2 is lived out in our life. We're saying, well, I thought Romans 12, 1 and 2 was only good if the sun was shining, if my car was running, if all the relationships were cool, if I had no threat hanging over my head because of the job situation or the job market, you know. No, it's not just in favorable, it's in any set of circumstances, right? That Romans 12, 1 and 2 is in effect, the living sacrifice, and how this role of submission. So we're thinking of how is it that it honors God. Maybe if you have a little ribbon thing like this or a piece of paper, put it over in 1 Peter because we'll go back there too. But in 1 Peter chapter 2, 12 and 13, notice Peter has to wrestle with this same issue. And if you remember, the sword-carrying Peter in the garden whacked off Malchus's ear. That wasn't too much of a submission sign of submitting to authority then. Of course, Jesus put the ear back on and healed it and so on like that. But it says in 1 Peter 2, 12, it says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles. Now there's what they call a henna clause, or a so that in the thing which they slander you as evildoers, They may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority, or verse 14, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do what is right. Now you say to yourself, well, okay, Caesar allowed Pontius Pilate to be a governor over in Jerusalem area. What gives with that? Does he fit in here? How can he be viewed as an instrument of righteousness? Well, again, we don't know all of the decisions, all the things that were done, but we also know that he was a part of following through with making sure that God's plan was fulfilled of Jesus dying on the cross for their sin. There just wasn't any other way. It had to happen because three people decided on it: God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit in eternity past. So it was going down because they wanted it to happen, because they had planned for it to happen, and it had to happen because there had to be a payment for your sin and for mine. So it was going to be because of sin, not because Pilate was, well, okay, I'll not listen to my, you know, I'll wash my hands of this, and whatever you guys do from now on is on you, not on me. It wasn't that at all. It was an eternity past thing, obviously. Wasn't a mistake. It wasn't like, oh, man, I wish there was some other way. You know, God the Father wasn't saying those kind of things. So you have the situation that is there in 1 Peter where he is saying, hey, you do the right thing because it honors God and it puts God in a place, not you, but it puts God in a place where he hears praise in heaven, maybe even at the great white throne judgment just before these people who are non-believers. They'll even be praising God while they're being sentenced to eternity in hell, according to what's going on in Revelation 20. It's an amazing thing. That'll be the last word. Every knee will bow. Every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. What are they also going to have on their minds? It's not like their minds are going to be blank. They're going to be having on their minds your act of submission to God's plan as they see you doing the things, whether it's, let's love each other as spouses, you know, Randy, love Beverly as Christ loves the church. If I do that, I don't do it for so that I'll get, you know, points amongst people, but so that God is honored and glorified through any act of obedience that he gives me the help and the strength and the, you know, impetus to do. So you have the opportunity through submission, even in situations that you don't care for, to bring honor and glory back to the Lord through your submission. You also gain the help and the favor of God over the condemnation of God. Look at 13:2. It says, therefore, whoever exists in authority has, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, or opposed the ordinance of God refers to something that God created. So that whoever resists authority has opposed something that God set up, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. You say, whoa, man, you mean if I resist, if I go around talking about I don't like this, I don't like that, I don't like, that's resisting. And that brings God's attention to you, but not with a smile on the face, right? Now, we know in human terms, do we not? You know, husbands, you know, we think for a moment, I mean, Beverly's down here, she can't hear me saying these things, but we know, you know, would I rather be acting around my house and relating myself towards Beverly so that she, you've heard me these humming stories, so that she continues humming through the day. In other words, so she has a pleasant disposition and pleasant thoughts in her heart. Would I rather have that, or would I rather have Beverly's suspicion? Her, you know, dander kicked up, so to speak, or something that is in an aggravated state, which is going to be better for Randy? You know already, Beverly humming is better for Randy than Beverly aggravated is a lot better, you know, and so on like that. So we automatically kick in gear and we say, okay, think about your boss at work. You know, you don't say some things about your boss with him or her standing there because you know that registers. This person is that way, disloyal, this way, that way, no chance of whatever. I was starting to like you, but now that I heard you say that to my face, so we don't say that because we want his or her favor. It's so obvious what we're going to do when the supervisor is around. Look busy, here comes that up. We're having inspections this week, so we make sure things. Craig just went through that at work. The big bosses, you know who those guys are, whoever they are, the big bosses of every company, they come in, and so everything has to look well. The system needs to be functioning well. People need to be relating themselves. Big bosses don't want to come in and see you arguing with other people over petty stuff. They don't want to say, hey, big boss, come over here. You wouldn't believe what she did. They don't want to hear all that kind of stuff, do they? And so we know that, so we don't do it because we want their approval and not their condemnation. I mean, you know, it could go on forever. Kids who are, there's a few that are listening about that whose heads I can't see, but there's we got a representative over here too of so they know it's so much better to be in good standing, so to speak, with parents. Why is that? Because come college days, if you young people don't know it already, you're going to be in a ton of need. You're going to be broke, so broke that you can't even go buy yourself a Coke somewhere. And so you will lift up the phone and you will call your mother and father and you will explain with tears in your voice, I am so broke, I can't buy a Coke. And you know, because of this favor that you have, because you've been doing your chores, you've been doing jobs, you've been doing things that are helpful. When they say take out the trash, you don't say, look, I'm in stage whatever of my game and I'm going to go to get, I really feel good about today, I'm really working it. And so I'll do it later. If you say, I'll drop, pause, and go, I'm telling you, man, the shirt will come off the back, so to speak, when you're in need, which you will be one of these days. Now, switching over to verse 2, he's not talking about kids with parents, husbands with wives, bosses with employees, is he? He's talking about the God of the universe with all power and all authority. And the question is posed to us, do you really want to make him aggravated with you? By yanking on his chain, saying, you messed up, God, by placing this person in authority. You have heard just like I have heard, and it's hard not to. Somebody that we view as an unjust judge, but if I go and complain and yank on the chain of and show aggravation and jump up and down outside their offices to this judge that I think is not listening to my cause, I am saying that directly against Jesus Christ. Period. And I'm saying, you didn't know what you were doing by allowing him or her to get elected. And he's saying, oh yeah, if you will walk with me, talk with me, learn from me, we can walk through this and you'll see me insert my power and authority over said judge or judges, and things will be worked out so that you'll see a Romans 8:28 type of situation instead of pure aggravation coming out of this court case, even if you lose. We gain the favor of God. Submission should make sense because we gain the favor of God. Keep your finger there in Romans. You got to go way, way, way back into Chronicles. If you hit 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Samuel, you've gone too far. Just drop back to 2 Chronicles 30, like is listed there. And verses 6 and 7. Beverly, the other day, I was half awake and said, do you want to hear something from God to you? Here's a something. It says, the couriers went through in 2 Chronicles 30. Couriers went throughout all Israel and Jerusalem with letters from the hand of the king and his princes, even according to the command of the king, saying, O sons of Israel, Now put your heart into this, your life into this. Return to the Lord God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, or Jacob, that he may return to those of whom escaped and are left from the hand of the kings of Assyria. You might say to yourself, well, God let the Assyrians come down and wipe out and deport and split families apart, which they did. They were ruthless. They were nasty. They were evil, with a capital E. Why would I want to? Do not be like your fathers and your brothers who were unfaithful to the Lord God of their fathers, so that he made them a horror, as you see. Verse 8, do not stiffen your neck. You know what that is. Don't be stiff-necked like your fathers, but yield to the Lord and enter his sanctuary, which he has consecrated forever. Serve the Lord your God, that his burning anger may turn away from you. Verse 9, and if you return to the Lord, your brothers and your sons will find compassion before those who led them captive and will return to this land. For the Lord your God is gracious and compassionate and will not turn his face away from you if you return to him. I find that to be so amazing and so enlightening. And these people were being asked to say, God has another reason. He has a huge opportunity here for you to honor him, for you to be a cause him or compel him to be a huge blessing to other people through your obedience and through your returning. I do not want to have anything to do with going down to Jerusalem and worshiping God. He allowed the Assyrians to come in and decimate my family. I still see them to this day screaming as they're dragged away. How in the world can you say return to that God who didn't allow circumstances to work out or blast the Assyrians like in the day of Hezekiah with an angel that killed 186,000 of them all in one evening? Well, sometimes God doesn't deliver people in that way. He doesn't work out the most powerful effect of his will through, I'll bless you, goodbye to your problems, I'll bless you, here's a several $1,000s, I understand you have this or that bill, kabang, kabang, kabang. You know, he doesn't just do that. He doesn't send airplanes all over the world dropping parachutes that land in special yards with just the right thing and answer every single day, you know, with angels flying them and all that kind of stuff. So, he drops in the lap of some parents a Down syndrome situation. And the parent can either go, oh, my word, God, you messed up so bad, and there is no way I'm taking this. Some people find that out while the baby is still in the womb, when laws do not prevent abortion, and they say, I don't want that mess that God is allowing in my life. So it's abortion time. You see how these things work out sometimes in people's lives? I thought when I went over to this country, Stephen Philippi could be saying that since I'm here helping in the hospital in Bangladesh, that people would be nice to me. They're not. But he's still laying hold of, in principle, to this 2 Chronicles chapter 30. But yield the Lord and enter his sanctuary, which he has consecrated forever, and serve the Lord your God, that his burning anger may turn away from you. And then it says, so he'll have compassion. In other words, even through your obedience to a difficult situation, a tough boss, a bad judge, or whatever it is, an antagonistic person in your life. And it's hard for me to say that to people. I can't say that I like it, you know. If I have a dear, loving wife, and I'm telling somebody else, you know, you hang in there, wife, even though your husband is doing this, or vice versa, whatever. We have a major reason to embrace and worship God and submit ourselves to everything that he brings, because the well done follows obedience. The well done does not follow apathy. So what we do to keep in right standing with God is always right to do, even in the face of bad stuff. Verse 3 moves on to say, you have no reason to fear for the law. That's one of the benefits of submission. When the siren goes off, or you see the lights chasing behind you down the road, it's not you that they're after. It's somebody else. For the rulers are not a cause for fear, in verse 3, for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have the praise of the same. You have never been arrested. You've never been pulled over. It's usually the case, you know, for going whatever the speed limit is, or somewhat reasonably close to the speed limit, whatever that is. And I'm not encouraging you to do the whatever, but nonetheless, you're not accosted for those things. They don't have a file on me down at the local precinct in Hackettstown with saying, we're going to get this guy, we're going to watch him, because I saw him loading the loading truck or helping a person. They only think I'm going to keep an eye on somebody because they're busting people's chops, they're aggravating, they're causing domestic violence, they're doing all kinds of things that are going on. So you don't have to fear. Now, that's not saying anybody is perfect or anything. We all make mistakes. But you focus on obeying the law, and even the hostile government's eye looks elsewhere. I've heard missionaries say from countries that have Islam rule or Sharia law that even though you do have to watch how you handle yourself in terms of the obvious nature of your witness, you can defray or deflect the watchful eye of government upon you by being a very sincere law-abiding citizen. Notice in verse 4, it's something that even takes it a step further. Not only are they not looking at you, but it says in verse 4, for it is a minister of God, referring to government, or this government setup, it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword for nothing or in vain, for it is a minister of God, an avenger of things, or avenger who brings wrath on one who practices evil. So in other words, he's saying stay in submission to government because God is using this government to cancel some of the evil or to keep things in check or to come to your rescue when you need it because evil has descended upon your life. You might say, well, I don't see it every single time. Well, God has his purposes for those kind of things. You know what a minister of God is. A minister of God is a servant of God's. A minister of God is somebody who does what the Lord tells. In Psalm 139, it talks about, and aren't his angels, you know, his ministers, referring to they'd execute his will every time the exact way that he wants it. You know, how does God use the government's authority to serve you now? You can go to sleep at night. Maybe the patrol car, the New Jersey State Police, doesn't come by your place. Maybe once a day, maybe twice a week, whatever it is. But their presence is out there. Why are the two guys, have they been found yet that escaped from the prison in Clifton? Why are they hiding? Why are they not just walking down the road? Eating at the local diner. Because they're afraid of the authorities. Because they don't bear the sword in vain. They're going to take care of such who do things like that. And so that's why they're hiding and sneaking around and trying to be undetected. They will get caught. But we are free because the government is God's minister. That's what happened in Acts chapter 16. We don't have to go through and read all these, but in Acts chapter 16, Paul is out there proclaiming something about the Word of God. Then he gets to the part of Jesus being the Messiah, the true Son of God, and the folks in town who did not want him saying that create an uproar. A mob forms, and they get all upset, and who steps in and prevents it all? They drag him into the hall of Tiberius, it says, in the town of Ephesus, and they're about ready to kill him, and somebody steps in. It's called a Roman provincial leader who is commissioned to take care of people with Roman citizenship. That's what Paul had. So the God used these guys, not maybe because they wanted to, not because they cared, but because it was their charge. You take care of Roman citizens, and I don't want to hear back in the city of Rome that you're not taking care of Roman citizens. So they have that hanging over their heads, so they come and they rescue Paul from the mob, and they allow him to speak, and his testimony gets shared. Same thing with King Agrippa, same thing with Festus in Acts 22 and Acts 26. He gets to share his testimony under the sanctioned protection of government when they, maybe the guys in the audience are trying to hold their ears or whatever it is, but they're protecting. They're being used as God's instruments. Notice what it says in 5 and 6 as we close. It says, therefore, it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, that is, not only because bad things can happen to those who do evil, but also for conscience sake. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, notice it says, devoting themselves to this very thing, render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom is due. Fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. Sounds like this guy Paul, who writes this, has been listening to who? The guy steps out of the crowd saying, I'll trick Jesus. And he asks, who do we pay taxes to? And you know what Jesus says in response to that? Whose head is on the coin while Caesar's head is on the coin? So he says, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God. In other words, the existence of a government, whether it's antagonistic to Christ or whatever, does not block you from serving God in a clear fashion. There should be nobody on the planet who has the power over you so much with the emotional trauma and the drama and all that they may or may not intentionally bring into your life. And I know maybe everyone has a drama person, you know, in your life that is producing ill will and acting out of spite and trying to get even with you for something you didn't even do or put you down so they can get ahead. It may be that everyone here has that going on, or what you would consider to be an unfair situation, a bad deal. God has left me alone to suffer on this one or something like that. But in every one of those situations, God is superintending, and we need to owe God or pay to God what he is rightly deserves, it says here. You know, taxes to whom taxes are due. Well, that's to the evil people. Well, they're not going to use them right. He persecutes. I said pay the tax. Because you're also benefiting from their protection from the Mongolian hordes or whatever who are trying to attack the Roman Empire and do even worse things to you. So you're in Romans. Turn back to the right, just one book, to Acts chapter 24, a few pages, and look at verse 16. 24:16. And what does it say? In view of this, I also do my best to maintain always a blameless conscience, both before God and before men. How do you maintain a blameless conscience? You do what God calls you to do, what you know he tells you is the right thing to do in that set of circumstances. You don't rationalize, you don't criticize, you don't say I'll withhold, you don't say anything. You just, if there's something you want to appeal, okay, appeal, but in a appropriate way. Speak the truth in love, do all kinds of things. So the question that comes out of this is clear conscience business is, upon who is your attention focused when you're looking to maintain a clear conscience? When the teacher walks in the room of your classroom and says, who wrote this note that was left on my desk? that is expressing whatever, some anonymous disgust with the way the test was. You didn't prepare us for this test, the blah, 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 blah. You know, sometimes teachers get notes like that on their desk and it's not signed. Are they going to have suspicion of you? Should they? Because there's the voice of backbiting or laughing at jokes at the expense of the teacher. She is, he is, this way. If you're not a part of any of that, then you have a clear conscience and you don't have to worry. The same thing for the boss at work. If you're not the one who yanks on the boss's chain, who goes and talks to other people, which will always get back to the boss in some way, then they know you're not the kind that you're the kind that stifles those kind of conversations. You're the one who cancels out the laughter. You're the one who says, you know, hey, let's not go there with our conversation. You're the one who is generally supportive and tries his or her best at the job every day. So you have a clear conscience because of your submission to the Lord. So I want to encourage you to think through these first seven verses and think about the value of submission. Think about the benefits that come your way of, you know, the fact that they have no evil thing to think of you, the fact that they will be praising God in heaven as they reflect on. I don't know if you realize the power of that, but there are words that are going to come out of people's mouths who know you, who saw you obeying Jesus Christ for the sake of obeying Jesus Christ, that are going to be voiced verbally before Jesus, the Son of God, as that testimony is yanked out of their heart and mind by Jesus Christ, and they will be praising the Lord for putting you in their life and putting a spirit of obedience and submission in your heart and living that with sincerity, and that will be voiced as praise, even though it will also be a reason why they are self-condemning themselves. Hey, what did I do wrong? What's up, man? You can't throw me down there in that, you know, burning lake of sulfur. I'm a nice person. And then the testimony will come out and praise will be given to Jesus Christ seated at the great white throne judgment. That's not going to be anything that we hear. We're not going to hear a word of that. We're going to be in a different situation. We're going to be rejoicing in Jesus Christ. We're not going to be standing around the outside. See, I told you so. Nah, 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 nah. You got him even. Toss him, toss him, toss him. You know, we're just going to be thankful that God worked in our hearts.